So I've asked Anna to upload some PDF files in the wiki, including the original paper by Wald, but also some lecture notes by some other well-known characters, where this formula and associated issues are discussed at length. In particular, keep in mind that around the time, so it wasn't just Wald, some number of papers by various authors appeared, including the ones by Rob Myers. And I will leave it to you as an exercise to explore this subject. In particular, one question that you might be asking is whether or not, so we had this theorem in black hole mechanics about the increase of the Bekenstein-Hawking formula in physical process, classical process. And you may ask whether or not this is true for generalization of Bekenstein-Hawking formula given by Wald. That's a non-trivial question to ask. And in fact, the discussion of this formula and consequences continues. And there are some research papers that appear in sort of last year and year before. Now, this coefficient, so one exercise that you might want to do is, as I mentioned yesterday, so you can compute for the Einstein-Hilbert action what the Wald expression gives and convince yourself that it gives nothing but the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, 1/4 of the horizon area. Now, this object that I yesterday wrote as d sigma mu nu alpha beta can be deciphered. And again, I urge you to consult the literature and do the calculations. But let's say in four dimensions, we are talking about the following object with four indices, and this epsilon is the so-called binormal that can be given, for example, in terms of the Killing vector. Like this, and we integrate over the surface. So this is the usual induced metric on the horizon, and you integrate over. So you can do the exercise when L is nothing but, so if L is equal to 1 over 16 pi, all right, so some units, and G is equal to 1, R mu nu alpha beta G nu alpha G nu beta, and take this derivative and then think about these binormals. And the only non-trivial pieces of binormals will be epsilon RT, which is equal to epsilon minus TR. So you can play with it and discover that this is nothing but 1/4 of the horizon area. But of course, this formula was written not for this particular application, but just in case then you have L, which depends on higher derivative terms entering the discussion. In this case, there will be corrections to that, and there is some subject to a discussion. So somebody asked yesterday about the physical intuitive sort of explanation of why this result appears in the form it appears. And I'm not sure if I can give a good intuitive explanation of that, but on the philosophical level, the discourse that leads to this expression is effectively no different from analyzing the analog of the Noether theorem, but now including gravity, right? So of course, when you do the usual exercise with Noether theorem, you have some symmetries. And once you have gravity, that means that you have some Killing vectors, for example, right? You have some symmetries. And the Noether theorem in field theory would give you an explicit construction of a conserved charge when you vary your action under the under those symmetries, right? There is some variation, but this variation, if the action is, if your theory is symmetric, supposed to be equal to zero. So that would give you explicit construction for neutral charges. So philosophically, what leads to this formula is the repetition of this exercise, but now including gravitational degrees of freedom. Then of course you have to do this, keeping in mind that in gravity you define your conserved charges not locally, but you have to integrate over the huge surface that encircles the theory in question, right? So you have to define the ADM mass and other quantities, right? So this formalism is a neutral theorem generalized to the case of gravity, and in particular high derivative gravity, then L depends on non-trivially depends on, so it contains this action, but also some pieces such as, for example, R mu nu, lambda sigma, R mu nu, lambda sigma, and infinite number of similar terms. Okay. So there is some interesting piece in that story for people who want to explore this. The references are given, and we can talk more about this if you are interested. All right, but we'll continue with building up the ADS-CFT correspondence. That's our ultimate goal. And today we'll discuss some elements coming from string theory. That will be necessary for this construction. So, first of all, remember that we have strings and brains in string theory, and in fact, you can say that string theory, as we understand it now, is a quantum theory of interacting relativistic one and higher dimensional objects. And fundamental parameter will be the tension of the string. So there's a fundamental parameter originally entering the string action as the tension, where alpha prime is the it has a dimension of length squared, and this is the length of the string squared. We need this parameter because the action, so if you have a propagating string, then similar to, let's say, a point-like particle, you have to write down dimensionless action, and since you're integrating over the world volume of the propagating one-dimensional object, you have to have something that would normalize this to make it dimensionless, and this something has to enter as a fundamental length squared in the tension in front of this action. So here, G alpha beta is given by the embedding alpha, yeah, sigma, beta is the induced metric. And so the sigmas are the sigmas of the coordinates on the world sheet. So alpha is 0 or 1, and the coordinates xm, so the embedding functions, here m goes from 0 to d minus 1, generically. So the strings will be considered in first quantized formalism. Remark, so we are considering strings in first quantized so you can see also the treatment of a point like, especially point like particle in the same formalism, and supersymmetric particle, right, and point like object. In the same formalism. So just to have an analogy. In books by Green, Schwartz, Witten, Brink and Noh, and other sources. All right. There exists a formalism known as string field theory. So this is a remark for those of you, well, perhaps you know all this, but we'll not need a string field theory for building up the correspondence. So that is just for as a remark. So what you do usually, so I'm just reviewing this stuff that you hopefully you actually know. So if you quantize quantizing the string action so in practice an equivalent Polyakov action one finds the following. One finds that, first of all, there exists a finite number of massless modes and these modes will be our primary concern, and an infinite tower of massive modes. With masses proportional to string mass, which is LS to power minus one. It's one parameter. And depending on the boundary condition, so you have this tower, and then depending on the boundary conditions, in this quantization, in the boundary conditions, one finds several self-consistent, in fact, five self-consistent theories. So usually called type 2A, type 2B. And then there is type 1. And then there are two heterotics, so heterotic with different groups, 8 cross 8, and so 32. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And all of them are considered to be various limits of the so-called M theory. Now, another thing is that the various conditions, such as the absence of negative norm states, in supersymmetric formulation of the string, require dimension being equal to 10, and then the string interactions are controlled by the string coupling constant GS. So there are pictures that I will dare to reproduce. Here's some string. And then production is probably not very faithful. But the idea is that there is some vertex. And here is a merger. So you can think of a closed string propagating, for example, from left to right. And here you have a vertex, which describes a merger of two closed strings. And then again, there is another vertex. And the interaction is controlled. The coupling constant of interaction is called GS. So in the low energy limit, this corresponds to the diagram describing the exchange of the graviton. So for closed string theory, there is a graviton in the spectrum. And you can think of a limit in which this becomes the exchange of the graviton. And therefore, there is a relationship between, so that reduces to the usual perturbative gravity. And therefore, there is a relationship between GS and the Newton constant G in 10 dimensions. And this relationship is the following. There are some coefficients involved, but the GS squared LS to power 8. As we know from previous discussion, it must be power of length to power 8 of some length involved. But this GS squared comes from identification of the low energy limit of the diagram like this. So that's why it enters as a square. Now, more generically, you have a interaction with various loops. Up. Yeah, just a second. Yeah.
So going back to number two, does the D equal 10, when you say negative norm states, you mean tachyons? And so that's.
There are different, there are several ways to find this result. So they are, so it's not one calculation gives us D equals 10. So you can require that, and you can require Lorentz invariance in the ambient state and ambient space, and so there are several calculations that lead to this result. So there are interactions which are the infinite series of interactions with loops. So let me draw again this unhealthy looking diagram. And correction to that, again, something resembling an octopus, but now with a hole inside, some mutilated octopus, and there are many more, well, there are infinite number of these terms, and there is this factor gs to power 2h minus 2 in front of these diagrams. H is the number of holes. Number of holes. Now, one important piece of information that we will need to keep in mind is that GS is not a free parameter, unlike LS. Free parameter, it is related to the expectation value of the dilaton, one of the massless modes. So this is expectation value of dilaton, and dilaton is one of the massless modes of the massless modes in the spectrum. It is important because when we start building the gravity dual backgrounds, the dilaton will enter prominently in this set of equations of motion, which we will write on the board in 10 minutes or so. And it will be important to control the dilaton because if dilaton happens to be, that will depend on space-time coordinates in your background. And if it happens so that the dilaton becomes large somewhere, that would automatically mean that the string coupling constant becomes large, and therefore you have to take into account the string loops corrections to the three-level diagrams. And typically nobody knows how to do this, especially on curved space-time. And that would correspond in the language of ADS-CFT, that would correspond to taking into account 1 over n squared corrections, where n squared is the rank of the gauge group of the dual theory. And that's usually it's rather difficult to do. So that is a non-trivial. Okay, we'll come back to that issue. But right now, let's just realize that effectively, we have two parameters. One of them is LS, and another one is GS with all these remarks that I just made. Now, in the near future, when we build the gauge gravity duality, we'll build first the gauge string duality. Gauge string duality, and then immediately approximate this by gauge gravity duality. And this approximation would correspond to certain conditions that we will impose, and these conditions will involve typically inequalities like this, so that the standard length scale, for example, the length scale that enters our metric, which is a solution of equations of motion, such as analog of Schwarzschild radius or other parameters, typical length scale of radius of ADS, for example, must be much larger than the string scale LS. Otherwise, this geometry will undergo corrections. Yeah.
That expansion, is that in the first quantized or second quantized form?
In the first quantized form, okay. Yeah. So we'll have to keep in mind this inequality, but also this inequality, GS much less than 1. In particular, dilaton should not be too large. So where L where L is the characteristic size of our geometry, such as ADS radius in the metric, ADS Schwarzschild radius, or something like that. Okay, so these conditions correspond to this approximation, because we don't know. I mean, if we were able to have a full control over string theory and quantum level on a curved background, then we would be able to say various things about our gauge theories at arbitrary coupling and at arbitrary value of n. But we don't have this control, and therefore we need to make this approximation. This approximation ensures that we are sitting in the corner of the parameter space where n, such as number of colors, for example, is infinitely large, and that corresponds to this parameter being extremely small, going to zero, or the coupling constant, which in gauge theory will be a Hopf coupling constant, lambda, is infinitely large, and that corresponds to this limit, because otherwise will be corrections to our geometry, which in this case can be taken into account rather easily, well, fairly easily. But this case is much more difficult to go beyond this limit. Right. Now, we have also brains. And historically, in a way, the appearance of brains in string theory in mid-90s effectively led very quickly to the discovery of gauge string duality, although it wasn't obvious immediately. But so they enter as non-perturbative in GS, higher dimensional objects with the appropriate tension. I remind you that we are talking about mass per unit volume, which is proportional to 1 over GS LS to power P plus 1. So if this is a P plus 1 dimensional, higher dimensional meaning P plus 1 dimensional object, then L in this power must be here, just like L 1 over L squared must be there in case of 1 plus 1 dimensional world volume. But the interesting fact is that GS enters in the denominator. So these brains, they appear as topological defects of sorts. With P plus one dimensional world volume on which open strings can end. And of course, they are free to move along the world volume. Right, so so we won't need much of that. So you can, the picture, the intuitive picture, this I think is important to have in mind, is that you have these objects which are higher dimensional. So for example, P can be equal to 3. So our primary concern will be free brain, whose volume is 3 plus 1 dimensional. World volume, 3 plus 1 dimensional. And that means that you can imagine ourselves being kind of stuck on the surface of world volume of such a brain because we live in a 3+1 dimensional world. And then there are open strings attached to this brain, they're free to move along this world volume. So you can think of the elementary particle, such as an electron, for example, as the end point of this higher dimensional string, which goes into this 10 dimension, right? But the end point is stuck on this 3+1 dimensional world volume and free to move, right? So we observe these elementary particles moving around, but you can think of them as the low energy excitations of the end point of a string which goes into higher dimensions. So that's a picture that you might have in mind. And of course, these open strings that end, I mean, there are infinitely many of them, obviously, and they do interact. I mean, these endpoints, they interact. They vibrate according to the spectra of strings, and you can quantize those spectra just like you quantize the usual usual string in, say, flat space. And at low energy, so of course, there will be excitations which are massive, right, very highly energetic, but there are also excitations which are lower in energy. And with this picture, intuitive picture that I'm trying to outline, it's not a big surprise that you can try to write down the Lagrangian for the low energy excitations of these endpoints ending in 3+1 dimensional hypersurface. And these low energy excitations in the low energy limits, right, not taking into account these massive modes, will be described by theories that we all know. So this will be theories that will involve the usual massless modes, let's say scalars or Maxwell field, vector field, or some form fields and so on, right? So they will not be exotic. Most of them will not be exotic fields, and this is no different from considering the usual field theories such as Maxwell or gauge theory, living in this 3+1 dimensional world volume. So generically, all these degrees of freedom and that means open and closed strings and various brains are excited. So you can imagine, so they are excited and excited as quantum objects. So you can easily imagine, well, not maybe not easily, in fact, it might be a nightmare, right? So there are these brains on which strings end, all of this vibrates. Of course, you have the interaction between open strings and closed strings. So there are strings that are, so you have this topological defect, these hypersurfaces. And there are many of them, in fact, infinitely many of them, right? And then there are open strings stretched between them. There are open strings which end with endpoints on the same brain. There are closed strings in the bulk. There is interaction between open and closed strings. So all of this is excited in quantum level, and it's a horrible mess. That's what I wanted to convey. However, you can try to consider a certain limit. Try to say that these objects, to some degree, you can think of field theory. In field theory, as we briefly discussed in second lecture, I think if you think of field theoretic models, so typically you look for perturbative and non-perturbative degrees of freedom, right? So remember we had this example of Sine-Gordon, right, or Tyrannic model, when you have the perturbative mesonic excitations and then there are solitonic-like excitations, which typically go as 1/1 coupling squared. In this case, it's 1/1 coupling, but it's a typical in field theory, 1/1 coupling squared. And depending on what range of coupling you are talking about, you have either these guys excited or those guys excited, or perhaps these guys are heavy and these guys are light. But generically, at intermediate coupling, all of them are excited, and there are transitions between the two on a quantum level. So it's a horrible mess, which is very difficult to analyze, except when you have sufficient number of symmetries in your theory so that you constrain them, right? You have the muzzle, right? So you kind of, this mad dog is somehow restrained. But that only happens if you have sufficient power of symmetries that would tame those degrees of freedom. Otherwise, it's very difficult to disentangle them. What you can do, however, is to consider, you can consider the low energy limit so that all these interactions and so on is suppressed. So your very heavy modes are just sitting there, right? They're too heavy to participate in the game. And only massless modes are relevant. So, however, at low energy, and that all this means that our energies, which will be less than the standard scale entering the problem, which is 1 over string length, only the lowest states are of interest. Right? Now, for us here, the primary example will be one of these five string theories. This will be type 2B. So this is a theory of closed strings. So we consider a massless spectrum of that theory. And the massless spectrum contains, so again, I'm not proving anything so far. And in fact, I won't be doing that for this. I mean, this is part of a string theory course, and you can consult various books on string theory of how precisely to find this massless spectrum and other statements. So I'm just stating this without the proof. This was quantization. So it will be a graviton, and then there is a dilaton and axion. And then there are two forms, B mu nu and A mu nu. So these are rank 2 forms, anti-symmetric symmetric fields. Note that there are no Maxwell fields around, right? So then there is also a very important rank 4, mu nu lambda sigma. And let me put this across here. So this is rank 4 anti-symmetric form field, which is self-dual. Self-dual, and self-dual means that so when you take F, so this is A4, so F5, this is a potential, compute the field strength, and the field strength will obey self-duality condition like this. Okay, so these are our bosonic fields. Now, in addition to that, there are fermionic fields, psi 1 or 2, alpha. There are gravitini. And there are a certain number of dilatini dealing with supersymmetric supergravity. Now, again, in string theory courses, So once you, when you quantize a string, you discover these massless fields, and then you realize that in fact all these fields they form something very familiar, namely that this is n equals 2. Ten-dimensional supergravity, which was known, of course, independently of any string construction. So you have, and then there are massive modes, infinite number of massive modes that we won't bother with. So the main statement that will be of direct relevance for us is the following, that if you want to preserve, so preserving symmetries of a string action, and let me write it once, I mean we won't need it, but just to have it on board once, it's a Polyakov action. So d2x root of minus h ab ax. So this axis describe embedding of your string into the higher dimensional, 10-dimensional space. And then there is g mu, which in principle can depend on x. So this section plus supersymmetric extension thereof. So this describes the propagation of a string, but we want to preserve the symmetries at the quantum level. And this leads to a certain condition namely that in field theory it would be a beta function, but here you have a beta functional and they must be equal to zero to preserve the symmetries of the action. So this beta functional will depend on these axes. Let's call them x rho. And it is a calculation that was done in mid 80s. It's a non-trivial thing to do, but again, so we're not doing this in this course. I just refer you to, let's say, Green, Schwartz, Witten and the original papers, perhaps, because even there, I think it's not done in full detail. But the main result is that if you start computing with beta functionals from the world sheet, you discover that the condition, so beta functional is something that involves these massless modes, so lambda sigma mu h nu lambda sigma minus 2 derivative mu acting on the dilaton, and then there are corrections powers of alpha prime and higher, and this must be equal to zero. So this is a condition on low energy modes. So here, this H is the field strength of the rank 2 field B mu, which is generalization nu rho plus d rho b mu nu plus d nu b rho mu. So this is generalization of the usual Maxwell field strength that of course you well know. All right, so it is again. So we won't do this in any detail. This is just a fact which is stated as a fact. But we need to what you need to understand is where this whole thing is coming from. At least on a philosophical level, it is coming from the requirement, and this is a calculation, which is a non-trivial calculation. You do this, plus in principle, a long tail of corrections. So this is all expanded in powers of alpha. Sorry, yeah.
So we saw in our string theory course that the vanishing of the beta functional was supposed to reproduce Einstein's equations for the metric and the target space.
That's right.
But how is that? I mean, because this is reproducing R mu nu is say equal to something that looks like T mu.
Yeah, we will see in a moment. I will write down the questions explicitly.
Oh,
so it will. Yeah. Yes. That's it's one of the most appealing features of string theory. Of course, very old feature from mid 80s. And you look at the low energy self consistent description of a theory, and you recover general relativity. So you must at least well. You recover, of course, general relativity plus coupled to some other field. So this will be this equations that R mu is equal to the right hand side will be supplemented by equations to other fields such as dilaton, axion, and all this massless mode. So it won't be just Einstein's equation alone, right? So it cannot be. But this is a very appealing feature. All right. So so one thing that I would like it I want to ask you to understand is that this is an infinite series, and it is done as an expansion in powers of alpha prime, right? Because you can think of the alpha prime. So I mentioned already that we have effectively two parameters. So one of them is alpha prime or L string, which is the same up to square and GS, right? And so L string is literally is a length of this one-dimensional object. So if I expand in powers of alpha prime, it means that to the zero further approximation, my alpha prime is zero. Therefore, my string is approximated by a point-like object. And so you're dealing with point-like object. And then you compute corrections effectively as corrections of string geometry, right? The fact that our strings are extended objects, not point-like. And this is translated into this series in alpha prime corrections, and there are infinitely many of them. But because alpha prime is dimension full, right? So these corrections will be suppressed, just like in when we consider it with correct high derivative corrections to the Einstein-Hilbert action. All this tail will only, of course, it will give corrections to the usual Einstein's equations with the precise coefficients, unlike the generic case when I know that they must appear, there are all these corrections with some coefficients, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3, but I don't control this alpha 1, alpha 2, and so on. Here, all these coefficients are calculable within string theory, and they are predicted precisely, right? So which precisely high derivative terms enter the game. Now, the trouble is, so of course, it would be wonderful just to go and measure precisely the corrections to Einstein's equations coming from string theory predictions. But as we discussed yesterday, they're extremely small because all of this is suppressed by powers of L Planck over L, where capital L is the size of our typical geometry, such as a Schwarzschild solution or a similar thing. So they're extremely small. So now comes the crucial moment in some sense. Because I will write down the type 2B low energy equations of motion. And this is something that we will use for our ADS-FT correspondence explicitly, right? So these equations, will follow from these beta functionals equal to zero. So one of them will be R mu equal to the right hand side from that equation, but will be more.
So let me try not to make a mistake here, because we will actually use them. So Rμ nu is equal to, when I write Rμ nu, that's something that you had seen also in the exercises, right? So you can write down an exercise equation says Rμ nu minus 1/2 Gμ nu R equal to T Mu nu with some coefficient, but you can trace this whole thing, right? Express R, the scalar curvature, as a trace of T Mu nu and some other fields and put it in the equation. So effectively, your Einstein's equation will read as R Mu nu equal to the right-hand side. And this is precisely what is happening here. So we write down R Mu nu is equal to this right-hand side. And this right-hand side, as you can easily, as you can probably observe, will involve some pieces that resemble the stress energy tensor of the appropriate fields, traced appropriately. So mu alpha beta h nu alpha beta minus 1/2 g mu nu h squared plus e to the 2 phi 1/2. So this is the axion. And then there is 1/4 e to the phi. So the dilaton is everywhere. And here we have another trace of another form, which is mu lambda sigma f nu lambda sigma minus 1/2 g mu nu f squared. So this is our free form number 2. And then there is one important piece in this equation, 1/96 f mu lambda rho sigma kappa tilde f nu lambda rho sigma kappa. That's the end of the equation. This is our phi form, the one which is self-dual. Okay. So again, and this is equation number 1, but it's not the only one. There is also the box acting on phi. It is coupled to the axion. And then there are metra fields e to the minus phi h squared. This is a free form plus 1/12. Hope the sign is correct. Phi. Another free form. And then there is an equation. So this is equation number 2. Equation number 3 is the one for the axion, but this is the axion which is coupled to gravity. So you have 2 phi d nu c. And here we have minus 1/6 e to the phi h mu nu sigma f tilde mu nu sigma. Almost done. Well, not quite, right? So then there are equations resembling, well, they are effectively Maxwell's equations, which I will write in the notation of the forms, because this is more convenient. And I will define various quantities that enter here. This is F3 is equal to F5 veg H3. Then there is a wonderful equation. And the last one. So D C F3 e to the phi minus h3 e to the minus phi equal to f3 vetch f3. That's interesting. I think, sorry, it's the free h3 here. There is no sigma. And so, okay, so these are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? So these are kind of Maxwell's equation. It's the analog of the scalar equations, one for dilaton, one for axion. This is analog of, well, this is Einstein's equations, effectively. Then there is a very important self-duality condition for F5. F5 tilde, and the Bianchi identity for F3. And F5 tilde. Yeah, that's okay. So so these are Bianchi. So here the notations are that F tilde 3 was the form F3 minus the axion times the form H3. Now F3 itself is the field strength of our potential A2, and H3 is the field strength of the two form B2. And finally, F5 tilde, so let me write it here, F5 tilde is F5 minus 1 half A2 veg H3 plus 1 half B2 veg F3. Let me see, yes. And the usual notations. So it looks like a mess, but it's actually quite, you know, you can, at least long time ago, I actually derived those equations. And I mean, it's messy, but it's doable. I mean, you can actually work with this mess without being too frustrated. It's important to remember various notations, such as this one. So what is,
The last equation, when you have d star of cf tilde 3, it shouldn't have a...
This one?
Yeah, so the dimensions at both sides don't coincide. So at the right-hand side, you have a 6 form. On the left-hand side, you have an 8 form.
Is it 8 form? So the Hodge, okay, let's compute. Right.
It should be like a pipe somewhere at the right hand side.
Should be some.
So star of a 3 form is a 7 form, and right. Then you deviate and it's an 8 form.
And the right hand side is
F tilde 5, which
you
have to
change the star.
Are you talking about the next one?
D star?
Yeah, so it looks like, so if this is 3, right, then the Hodge will make it 7, and it will be E and E 8. Here we have only 6. Something is not quite right here. Okay, let me investigate this. Yeah, so
could it be star D instead of D star?
Star D, so let's see, D4. Yeah, could be. Not quite. Yeah, so perhaps, yeah, maybe. Okay, let me check this. So, so the notations are just to be self-consistent. I mean, to be consistent with what people are using in other books and so on. So I'm just writing this XIP, and the Hodge of phi is 1 over d minus p star, 1 over p star, epsilon I1 id square root of g phi j1 and so on jp, then there is g I1 I1 j1 g ip jp, and then there is dx I p plus 1 and so on dx id, right? So hopefully that coincides with a typical definition. Yeah, so I will check that equation, and yeah, check yourself also that at least they make sense. Our primary concern will be this equation for graviton, and what we are going to do is to, so basically, if you want to find the appropriate gravity dual in this approximation, then you have only classical gravities. You are looking for a classical gravitational background to your theory. All you have to do is to solve this system of coupled differential equations, and that solution will give you a certain, yeah, could be a class of solutions, but each of which will probably describe a certain gauge theory which is dual to such a background. Obviously, it's a coupled system of nonlinear PDEs, so it's difficult to expect that you easily find a solution. And nonetheless, a certain types of solutions were found by doing effectively what people were doing when they were looking for solutions like Schwarzschild and Reissner, Nordstrom, and so on. So you take a particular ansatz for your metric. So for example, you restrict it by symmetries. You say that, oh, I want something which is spherically symmetric, or I want something with a world volume which will be Poincaré invariant in, let's say, 3 plus 1 dimensions. You take this ansatz, you plug in, and ansatz for other fields, you plug in into these equations, and then you have a much simpler set of equations for the functions that enter the ansatz. And sometimes you can happily solve these equations, and sometimes exactly. So next time we will analyze a particular class of solutions, and also in your tutorials, I will ask you to do that. In particular, we will be interested in solutions which will describe p-brains in this gravity language, and that will occupy us maybe for one day or perhaps two. But one thing that you should appreciate now is that these equations are coupled. So the next step in holography, so when we find, so there'll be two steps. So one of them, finding the exact solution that would describe a particular gravitational background, such as a free brain, right? So that will be our primary solution. In the near horizon limit, this free brain will reduce to anti-de Sitter space ADS5 across the 5-sphere S5. You have learned various things about ADS metric already. But then step number two will be considering fluctuations of these backgrounds. Right, because remember, our philosophy is that we have this correspondence. We will have this correspondence between the, let's say, black hole or black brain solution and the quantum field theory in thermal equilibrium. But what we really want to do is to perturb it out of equilibrium and study the fluctuations. When we study the fluctuations, this means we take these equations and write down various fields involved in this equation, such as, for example, the metric will be g mu nu. The ground, the solution you found, plus a small fluctuation h mu nu. You also have a dilaton, which will be given by the background dilaton plus a small, let me call it little phi, and then axion, again the background axion plus a little c, and so on, right? And you You plug in these expansions into your system of equations, and you linearize, because you want to find the equations which govern small fluctuations. That will be linear PDEs, but also coupled. Also coupled. So remember that metric, for example, is sitting everywhere, right? It's sitting here, right? It's sitting somewhere inside the Hodge, right, and so on. So it's all coupled, right? So this is a fairly non-trivial exercise of how to write this down exactly without losing this coupling, right? Because sometimes if people say that, okay, so let's put all the fields to zero except metric, right? It will not be self-consistent because for other equations, this metric will act as a source of your fields. And you cannot, if you put it to zero, then the source will tell you that no, it cannot be zero because it is not self-consistent. Okay? So, all right, so stare at these equations for some time and then we'll discuss the exact solutions next time.